Proactive MD.
From MakoRx and Proactive MD, this is Healthcare Explained. I'm Jeremy Vanderknife.
And I'm Vinay Patel.
All right. We did get a good reception to our pilot episodes, I guess, our two-part pilot. So thank you to the three of you out there that have listened. What? Just kidding. It's more than that. But as a data guy, I'm interested in the analytics, and I'm interested in seeing if we see a steep drop off on this second episode, we're going to know it's us. We're going to know it's us.
That's right.
All right. We said we're going to start out each show with a little bit about ourselves. So again, Jeremy, I'm a medical anthropologist by training, work at Proactive MD, and am a data nerd. Vinay?
I am Vinay Patel. I'm a pharmacist by background for the last 20 or so years, working in various different areas of pharmacy, and co-founded MakeRx as an alternative to the status quo to try to provide some value into the healthcare system when what we see is just value extracted in the status quo.
Wonderful. And a fun fact about yourself for today's episode?
You know, I had one this morning when I was thinking about it, and I can't remember. It was a good one, too, and I can't remember what it was. We'll go with this one. I grew up and spent most of my upbringing on the East Coast near South Florida, or in South Florida, excuse me. And then I spent 3 years on the West Coast, and it's everything they say it is. It's beautiful. The weather's great outside of the earthquakes that you get on a random occasion. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to be. And the things that you get to do outside are just unmatched anywhere else in the country, in my opinion.
I love it. I love it. All right. I had a good one too, which I've since forgotten. So we'll go with this. I have gotten to experience, been through tornado, earthquake, hurricane, nothing so severe as many people have, and flooding. So,
wow.
So you wouldn't think all that stuff in South Carolina, but technically it's all happened. And so I think I need to collect wildfire.
And we need to get a bad system.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. I'm just trying to collect the natural disasters. All right. So we'll get into it. We'll get into today's show here, starting with some healthcare news. So Vinay, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah. So how about we give our listeners a quick recap of what we're going to talk about today? Because it's an exciting show that we've set up for them. And so we'll just do a quick rundown of what we're going to talk about today. We got the state of health insurance coverage in the U.S. I know the title sounds really boring, but there were some really interesting surveys results that have come out from this findings from the Commonwealth Fund 2024 Biennial Health Insurance Survey. And then we have what's killing us this week. We have rural hospital closures from information on the types of health systems or hospital systems that are closing around the country. And to no surprise, the rural areas are being impacted even more greatly than some suburban and urban sites, due to, you know, just availability of healthcare resources in those areas. Then we also have employers getting pressure to pay for drugs like Wegovy, an article in the Wall Street Journal that was published on November 19th. And we'll talk about how drug companies are now going and talking to large self-funded employers about the benefits of covering weight loss drugs like Wegovy. And then we have our healthcare explainer, what are compounding pharmacies? So stay tuned. We got an exciting show lined up for you, and we're going to kick things off with this survey. So just a couple of quick facts out of this 2024 biennial survey. Nearly one in four U.S. adults have health coverage all year, but are underinsured, facing high out-of-pocket costs and deductibles that force many to skip needed care or take on medical debt. Up to one-third of people with chronic conditions like heart failure and diabetes say they skip medication doses or don't fill their prescriptions because of the cost. And then two more quick facts. Among adults who were insured all year, so these are adults who are insured all year but underinsured, that means that they adults who had insurance but experienced one of the following: out-of-pocket costs, excluding premiums, equaled 10% or more of their household income. So that's what underinsured was defined in this survey. 66% of those adults who were insured but were underinsured had coverage through an employer. So two-thirds of those folks had insurance coverage through their employer. And then 29% of people with medical debt had employer-based health insurance. Statistics strike you at all, Jeremy, or are they surprising in how much coverage people have, but it may not necessarily be affordable? Healthcare may be affordable.
I mean, there's, you know, as a consumer of health insurance, it sometimes feels like the hole where you throw all of your money into, right?
Yeah.
Without being able to reap the benefits. And even when you think about health insurance, a lot of it is ends up being catastrophic coverage, right? It's just protection for, I don't want to spend the rest of my life in, you know, underwater in medical debt in case I get into a car accident or fall off a ladder, or, you know, get a complex disease. I think what's really striking is, you know, again, we have employer coverage in this U.S. It's the primary way, as this even said, right? 66% are getting it through the employer. And working with employers every day, they feel the burden of crushing healthcare costs.
That's
and,
right.
And they are caught between a rock and a hard place. And the one hand where, you know, the cost of coverage is increasing, the cost of medical plan insurance and their PBM and drug costs are increasing, right? 13%, 20%. We'll talk about GLP-1s and how those contribute. And then there's not a limit. If they try to push more of that burden onto employees through employee cost share by switching people onto high deductible plans and increasing the size of that deductible year over year to try to, for the employer to stay whole, it is equivalent to a massive pay cut in some instances for employees, which affects retention. It's not something that employers want to do, is for their employees to feel the pain like they do. But on the other hand, you know, not every company, very few companies in America are multi-billion dollar corporations, right? Mm-hmm. Where they're making record-breaking profits and, you know, the cost of health insurance is drop in the bucket. For so many employers, it's one of their, if not the largest, one of their largest costs that their company incurs is the cost of benefits for their employees. So they feel that pinch very acutely. And I mean, Vinay, from your perspective, what can employers do? How do they take this information back? And is there anything that employers can do about this? Or is it more just, this is the state of the nation, as it were?
I love to come back to this analogy and sort of metaphor that these are the brutal facts, that healthcare insurance is expensive. Healthcare doesn't need to be expensive, but healthcare insurance is really expensive and getting more and more expensive. And to your point, where we're spending money just to get access to care without even getting the care, we're spending money just to get access to that care, or the privilege to get access to that care. And so employers need to understand and realize with these brutal facts that they have to take ownership. They have to take agency in figuring out what they're going to do. I completely respect and understand that this is not their business. Healthcare is the last thing that someone who's in a manufacturing plant or someone that's in helps teachers figure out how to teach kids information they need to know to raise a healthy future for our country. It's the last thing on their mind. And they're not in the business of healthcare, and they don't think about this all the time. But finding the right resources, there's a couple of things that we recommend to employers. One, finding the right resources. That's a consultant that's actively engaged, that can give you ideas and share concepts and trends that are happening. And part of that is figuring out if you're a good fit for self-funding versus being fully insured. You don't have any control in fully insured. You have all the control in figuring out what you want to do for your health plan and understanding that information that you get when you're self-funded. And then understanding when you are self-funded, understanding those contracts. So figuring out what it means when you sign these agreements. That's what health insurance is all about, is you have to get into the details with understanding every single agreement that you sign. Because at the end of the day, you don't have any control if the contract doesn't say that you have these controls. And then finally, getting an expert that can help you on your team, that helps you understand some of these healthcare concepts at a provider level, whether it be a medical expert or whether it be a pharmacy expert that's on your team that tells you, okay, here's how it really works at the pharmacy. Here's how it really works when you see your doctor and when they recommend, when they're, you know, sort of belong to a health system and they recommend you go get imaging down the hall, it may not be the best for your plan. And here's how we get around that. And here's how we navigate to that care. What about on the primary care side, Jeremy? What do you guys What do you recommend? What have you seen that's helped?
I mean, obviously I'm biased. Shifting more care back to primary care in a value-based arrangement, like with an employer-sponsored health center, is a very strong play to be able to help bend the cost curve and be able to, you know, avoid some of those downstream costs. Because, you know, I think people will tend to forgo the preventive care, right? Even in these statistics that you mentioned, they're going without a prescription that they need.
That's right.
And those are some of the first things that we see that go. And well, I mean, you skip your insulin this month, right? You end up in the ER next month.
That's
and
right.
You both as a patient have higher out-of-pocket costs, and your employer then has higher costs as well if they're self-funded. And then it just perpetuates, right? That creates higher premiums because it's a riskier population. The one thing I'll say for if we have employer and plan sponsors who are out there listening is I've been in the room with these folks and you know, who are typically going to be HR managers and chief human resources officers.
Yes.
And they recognize the gravity of the decisions that they're making, which are not easy because they are faced in some cases with, you know, like you said, they have the ability to do whatever they want with the plan. So when you have a patient who's in need of a particular procedure and there's nothing in network, they're the ones who determine whether or not that plan will pay higher rate to allow that patient to go out of network. They're the ones who are authorizing a $400,000 a year cancer drug. You know, that's off formulary because this is potentially the only thing on the market that can keep this person healthy or provide them, you know, and lengthen their life as long as they can. But recognizing that when they make those decisions for a single employee or a single member of their plan, that the impacts are felt by everyone across their company. So
that's right.
You know, that's kind of my takeaway here is just, the business, nobody outside of healthcare wants to be in the business of healthcare, and yet everybody is.
Yes.
And these decisions that they're making, it's rough that it falls to the employer sometimes to have to make these decisions on how do we make our company sustainable while at the same time ensuring that our people can stay as healthy and happy and as productive as they can.
That's right. That's right. And I think that there are creative solutions out there. You have to get creative if you're going to find a way to try to tackle some of these cost burdens that employees are faced with. And the thing that everyone should be aware of is you don't have to do it alone. There's plenty of people out there that are in the healthcare field, have some connection to healthcare services that can help guide you and tell you, here's what you can and can't do. Here's why this is a good solution. Here's why it isn't. And
exactly.
That guidance can really help these employers make a more well-sounded decision rather than just fretting over, am I doing the right thing? I don't know what I'm doing.
You're balancing the legal, the ethical, and the financial decisions all at the same time. I mean, that is a difficult balance. And luckily, there are people that can support you as an employer in doing that. So
hopefully they have access to their data, right? So that they can know exactly what's going on. If you have a self-funded plan, but you don't have your data, it's going to be meaningless. So make sure you get that data that is truly yours and you deserve it as a health plan sponsor.
Absolutely right. So let's pivot as we're talking about you know, people not having the coverage that they need to our ongoing segment of what's killing us this week. I guess, again, right? Last week, it was what's not killing us this week. This week, I'm going to say it's what's not technically killing us this week, but might a year or two from now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And so the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform, middle of last month, released a report talking about where they have assessed the risk of closure for a number of rural hospitals in every state. And what they really found was 705 rural hospitals are at risk. And they're basing that, they've created their weighting criteria based on, you know, the current debt that these hospitals hold, the loss that they're getting, the delta between payment for services and cost for services, to be able to identify, hey, here are some that are at risk of if there's not a change to payment mechanisms or some new funding source that comes along that might be at risk of closing. And we see this is not just a crying wolf here. Rural hospitals are closing every year. And so one of the things that this report also pointed out was that I think this year 31 hospitals have eliminated inpatient services. And the reason they did that is because if they remove inpatient services, then they can qualify for federal grants for emergency hospitals.
That's right.
Which is an inpatient facility, they would not be able to qualify. And they're doing that to be able to keep their doors open.
That's
but
right.
The consequence of that is that now if you're in a rural area and you need to be admitted to the hospital, you will need to be transported potentially hours away to a facility that can take you and has bed availability.
That's right.
And so it just disproportionately affects rural America. These are the hospitals that, because they don't have the volume or the gamma knife or the latest and greatest technology for some of these procedures that, you know, a large academic institution might have or a metropolitan major hospital or health system would have, as a result of not having that volume and having that reimbursement, they just aren't able to receive the funds that they need to offset the cost of keeping a staff. To
That's
keep
right.
their doors open, you
That's
know,
right.
a hospital can't just be by appointment only, right, by definition. And so you imagine you've got a 24-hour staff. You need specialists that are available, hospitalists that are available. And it's a very difficult situation to be in as one of these rural hospitals. And so they raise a couple of points as the takeaways here in order to help protect these hospitals. And yeah, I'll just say as for just a question of scale, 38% of South Carolina's hospital, me being in the state, which is 9 hospitals, are at risk of closure. And more than half of those 9 are expected then to close in the next 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
If changes are not made. So
wow.
They're saying private insurance is just not paying enough and reimbursing, because you imagine the rate is the same for a hospital that has the volume as for one that does not have the volume in order to sustain those services, right? I mean, so the lower reimbursements from private insurance, more so than even though Medicare, Medicaid were mentioned, they said the biggest delta in reimbursement and cost of services is coming from private insurers.
So quick question there. Here's what I've always seen and read, and I don't know if this is accurate or not. This is a good discussion point. What I've seen again and read is that hospitals tend to state that they don't get enough reimbursement from Medicare and Medicaid, and so they have to overbill or overcharge or continue to jack up rates, reimbursement rates in the private or commercial markets to make up for that. This report may be saying something sort of the opposite or inverse of that.
At least it does. So it's saying that here, and I think to your point, Vinay, it's really well taken. They say they have to jack up the rates on the private and commercial insurance side. But again, those commercial insurers are going to come back and say, this is the ceiling, right? You know, you're asking for 30%. I'm going to give you 6%. And in those scenarios, it's one thing, I think, for a large metropolitan hospital. Again, everybody does whine about Medicare reimbursement rates, but just thinking this through, because I think you raised an excellent point. I think if you're a hospital that's got the volume, you probably have more leverage with a larger insurer as well, right? Because we saw that at the beginning of this year at South Carolina with Prisma Health and United Health Group got into a spat over reimbursement rates. And in those cases, you have two very large organizations that both have leverage over the patient, over the member, right?
That's right.
I've got you as a patient, you might leave the insurer and go to a competitor who's willing to pay me more, and you don't want that. And if you're likewise, the insurer has some leverage of, if you've got the richest network in town,
that's right.
That group is not,
access.
You know, knows that, yeah. I think that those smaller hospitals just don't necessarily have that type of cachet to be able to throw their weight around. And so they're saying that for these hospitals, it's the private insurance that's costing them.
Gotcha.
One of the things that they brought up that I thought was really interesting as we think about alternative payment mechanisms was standby capacity payments, that a term I hadn't heard before, but it makes a lot of sense. And this is this mechanism where, as we know, everything is fee for service. So if a service is not performed, the doctor and hospital do not get paid, right? So this is the idea of having insurers, federal or private, be able to actually create payment mechanisms to where hospitals can afford to have somebody on salary, even if they're not working. You may not need an acute trauma surgeon that day, but you need an acute trauma surgeon at the hospital, because when these incidents happen, these emergencies happen, you need that staff available, those providers, those clinicians, to be able to do it. So the idea here is can you create a mechanism by which hospitals can be paid in advance of any services being delivered, gotcha, just so that they can afford to have the necessary staff resources on their team ready and able to assist if an emergency happens.
Like a doctor on retainer.
Or exactly right.
A clinical team, a nurse, so on and so forth, on retainer, so that when they're ready, they can just sort of pull on the
exactly, and not have to depend on the volume of acute trauma surgeries.
That's right.
To be just able to offset the cost of having somebody available.
Oh, interesting.
So it's interesting from an employer standpoint. I think a lot of groups have employees living in rural areas, you know, mm-hmm, manufacturers, municipalities. I mean, just about every business you can imagine, maybe outside of, I don't know, Silicon Valley tech companies, right? Right. You will find in rural America. And so I think if you're an employer, be paying attention to this and really be focusing on where your employees are getting care. That's within right. Your different geographies that they live in. Because it is a concern. If you're somebody who you need to recruit, particularly from out of the area, mm-hmm, benefits are very important. And if you're, let's say, parents of young children or basically any children, or you yourself are getting up there in years and you're evaluating your options and mm-hmm, you're comparing jobs and one of them has great health care and the other one is going to be a 50-minute drive to the closest urgent care. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, the closest hospital is a 90-minute drive away. You might think, I don't feel safe in my current condition, right? I need healthcare accessible.
Definitely.
And with hospitals typically purchasing primary care practices as well, mm-hmm, if the hospital leaves, you're losing potentially an entire medical ecosystem that includes primary care, urgent care, certainly specialty care, because there's going to be no place for those folks to practice. So be aware of that, those access points, and pay attention to this. And think about even talking to your own, if you're a self-funded group, talk to your ASO carrier and stay on top of this for those areas. Make sure that you're not going to be going with a network as a self-funded insurer, selecting a carrier network that will not be able to serve employees because, hey, there's a disconnect between where they're getting care and what that network is willing to pay.
And to add to that, Jeremy, this is a conversation that came up recently, was just because there's a medical practice or clinic near you doesn't mean that you can be seen, mm-hmm, at the medical clinic. And so keeping track of what percent of employees are coming to you saying, I can't get an appointment for months, or I've just referred to this specialist and they don't have an appointment for another 10 weeks or 12 weeks. To be seen is sort of the next level of access that employers should be paying attention to, that, you know, just because they have medical facilities near them doesn't mean they necessarily can be seen
exactly
at those facilities
right.
when they need to be
exactly
seen. And that's
right.
sort of what we need to pay attention to and keep an eye on as far as employers are concerned, to help solve some of those problems that may be coming up here more often than not, especially after the pandemic, to figure out, you know, where they can access care.
Absolutely.
And same with pharmacies. Make sure you have, you know, we got the same parallel issues happening in rural areas of the country with pharmacy closures and creating medical and pharmacy deserts. And so pay attention to that as well, because once you see the doctor, you're going to need access to get treatment and medications. And so make sure there's something accessible in that regard as well.
Spoken like a true pharmacist. And that's a great addition. So switching gears.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something that nobody has ever mentioned in 2024. GLP-1s, weight loss drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy, et cetera. Vinay, what's the news there?
This was a fascinating article out of the Wall Street Journal, again, published on November 19th. Pharmaceutical companies have historically gone to talk to health insurance carriers, talk to doctors to try to get everyone aware of new treatments, new therapeutic categories that are coming to market that are going to help change patients' lives. We are now seeing a new trend with pharmaceutical companies, drug manufacturers going to talk to large self-funded employers. In this particular example, we had pharmaceutical representatives presenting to large self-funded employers to persuade them to provide coverage for GLP-1 weight loss drugs. And I think that the nature of the treatment here is really what's driving this new angle or new market to go after and get coverage for these drugs, because they're sort of a wild need for them from public awareness and now a public desire, demand for these medications, that the next sort of barrier to accessing these drugs is the over 50% of the market that's providing healthcare through their employer, getting healthcare through their employer, is denying access to these drugs that typically were seen as weight loss, cosmetic medications, or drugs that were in the cosmetic category, even though there's now more and more studies that are showing that there's a clinical indication beyond weight loss for these drugs. There's still a lot of factors to consider on, you know, for employers to consider, excuse me, that will members stay on the drug consistently to get benefits? So according to claims data analysis from Prime Therapeutics that was referenced in the article, about half of patients are still taking GLP-1 drugs after 180 days. Employee turnover needs to be taken into account. Long-term benefits are likely after 2 years of taking a GLP-1 drug. And there's still some unknowns around the long-term side effects. And so these are all just factors to consider when figuring out if you need to cover it. And there's definitely the employee retention. And as you mentioned, benefits are a great draw for employees to come and work at companies. Sometimes if they don't have access to enough employee benefits, they can leave an employer. And that's something really a sort of a very important factor to take into consider as well. And so one of the biggest concerns, as you had mentioned as well, introduction of this topic, was the cost. And so we're talking about drugs that cost roughly $1,000 a month, $12,000 to $15,000 a year for a patient that's taking it is going to be a big hit on the plan when you have 10%, 15% of the population taking these medications beyond the diabetes indication. Just as a corollary here, the Kaiser Family Foundation survey, this is a separate survey, showed that 59% of employers with 1,000 to 5,000 employees do not provide coverage for weight loss drugs today. And this was a Kaiser Family Foundation survey that was done just this year. And then among firms with 200 or more employees, 62% say that they are not likely to begin covering these medications for weight loss within the next 12 months.
Yeah. You know, Vinay, you and I were actually both up in Wisconsin yesterday meeting with some wonderful consultants. And, you know, the question comes up very often from employers and from consultants of, I get asked the question from a primary care perspective. I'm sure you get it asked from a pharmacy perspective. Well, what's your stance on GLP-1s? And my response is always like, well, who's asking, right? Because it is such a polarizing issue among employers right now, not just employers, but healthcare professionals, I'm sure pharmacists as well. This is the, I would argue, in my lifetime, one of the most illustrative examples of the cost-benefit analysis that self-funded employers have to do.
Yes.
And here we have a relatively new technology, right? A new technology hitting where there is, you know, inconsistencies in evidence. There's evidence-based research that's coming out that says, to your point, right, after long-term benefits. But if you're looking at somebody who's, you know, obese, overweight, and, you know, are there long-term cost benefits? There very well may be, right? And some early evidence is showing that there can be. There's also early evidence that shows, right, patient adherence is difficult. It's very expensive. Some patients might not stick with it, so you're out thousands of dollars. You get into that age-old question of, well, is this drug fixing something that should be behavioral choices, right? Are we just shifting the responsibility of change away from the individual onto the health plan? It is a mess right now, and employers are trying to navigate this mess, knowing that, you know, again, from a recruitment retention perspective, if you're a patient who's on one of these drugs, and you're looking to change employers, and one person offers, you know, coverage for this very expensive drug for weight loss, and you can continue that, that will be more attractive to you than, no, if you want to continue on this treatment path, you need to bear the cost out of pocket. But again, just at the top story that we had here around the rising healthcare costs and what that's doing for employers and everything else, this is a key driver. And all the major brokerage firms and consulting firms and everybody's hyper-focused right now on what is the right call to make today. We have imperfect information on the long-term benefits of this drug. We do know it is effective at weight loss. We do know that weight loss is correlated with lower healthcare costs downstream, right? Yep. We can reduce the incidence of more expensive chronic conditions or, you know, cardiovascular events, et cetera.
Right.
But we just don't have enough data to be able to know this is a slam dunk case, and
That's
every
right.
employer, every health plan in America would be crazy to not cover these drugs.
That's right.
And I think the medical profession, the pharmacy profession, employers, health insurers, everybody is trying to figure this out right now.
That's right.
And what a lot of people are feeling, though, is they're seeing the celebrity endorsements and they're seeing the commercials on TV. And so a lot of patients are clamoring for this and they want an answer quickly. And I just don't know in the next 12, maybe in the next 12 to 24 months. I mean, you know, Vinay, are you seeing more research coming out for these drugs?
Absolutely. It seems like every month we see a new study that shows that separating this from the weight loss, that there's some benefit to some other organ in the body, whether it's the kidney or the heart or the liver, that there's, you know, and the drug companies will continue to fund studies to prove additional benefit and sort of increase this data and this evidence that you should be supporting this for not only private payers, employer groups, self-funded employers, but also government payers like Medicare and Medicaid should be covering it. And in fact, North Carolina recently, as of this year, started covering weight loss drugs for their Medicaid population. And so we're now navigating this and figuring out what kind of cost impacts will we see next year from Medicaid from these decisions.
All right. So Vinay, talking about GLP-1s and on that same vein, if you will, compounding pharmacies, this comes up a lot. And I'm hearing the term a lot more as employers are looking to, should they turn to compounding pharmacies for the GLP-1s? Can you explain in this week's explainer, what is a compounding pharmacy and why is everybody talking about them with GLP-1?
So a compounding pharmacy is a pharmacy like, you know, not unlike a pharmacy you would go to get a medication like Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, your local mom and pop pharmacy down the street. They're licensed by the state. They're regulated by the Board of Pharmacy, and they have very strict standards that they must meet to be a compounding pharmacy. So it's not just anyone that opens up a pharmacy can be a compounding pharmacy. They have these particular regulations around them to make sure that they're serving the public safely and that they're meeting these quality standards that would be similar to what, in some cases, what drug manufacturers have to go through. And I want to make sure I'm very clear to separate compounding pharmacies from medi spas that may be dispensing and distributing weight loss medications or drug, and other organizations that may be claiming that they have access to these medications in some sort of compound form. If it doesn't come from a compounding pharmacy, you don't know the real source of that drug, but you do know when you do use a compounding pharmacy that it's licensed by the state, regulated by the Board of Pharmacy for that state, and that they meet really high quality standards to make sure. And there's two different types of compounding pharmacies as well. There's pharmacies that can dispense drugs to your pets and for creams and alternative dosage forms like liquids and special dosage forms that you can take by mouth. And then there's sterile compounding pharmacies that you need that have an even higher standard of purity, quality, and safety for these medications, because these are drugs you're injecting like GLP-1s into your body. And so there's even less of these compounding pharmacies that are sterile compounding out there.
So should employers consider sourcing these GLP-1s and these weight loss drugs from a compounding pharmacy? How does that work? And is that something that employers should or should not consider?
So a great question. And there's a couple different things to think about when you think about compounding pharmacy. One is they're allowed to compound these drugs, the GLP-1 drugs, today because of what's known as an FDA shortage list of medications that are in short supply for various different reasons. And so as long as they're on the shortage list, compounding pharmacies can compound the drug and make it available to the public. And these drug companies there's been some court battles over pharmacies that are compounding pharmacies that are supplying these medications and the drug manufacturer saying that we have enough supply now to supply the demand that is in the country. And so requesting that the FDA pull it off the shortage list. And there was a drug that was pulled off and then put back on because of these court battles that are going on between the manufacturers and these compounding pharmacies. And so they're regulated. It's a good source to get medications. Some of the things you need to consider is when will the medications not be available through compounding pharmacies? Compounding pharmacies currently are the least expensive way to access these medications when you take into account rebates and what it costs at the retail pharmacy and the retail price for these drugs. And so when will it stop? When will you stop having access to it? And then the other thing is, if you want to have some sort of cost sharing, go through the plan, access for these drugs, company pharmacies typically don't run insurance or process insurance. And so you'll need to either have some sort of special direct contracting relationship with a company pharmacy to set up that kind of arrangement, or just say, look, bill me for whatever patients that qualify on our plan to go to your pharmacy to get these drugs. And we'll just, the employer can cover 100% of those access. There's also access through programs that are available through telemedicine companies that can give you access to weight loss drugs. And they're also using compounding pharmacies, and those costs are still relatively low compared to the cost of the drug alone out there.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the explainer, Vinay.
Yeah.
On that note, I think that's our show today. So any parting words of wisdom for our listeners?
No, I'm going to pass this week.
I know. This week we just talked about, other than the GLP-1 compounding pharmacy, I feel like it was just a whole slate of bad news. I think our goal next week is maybe there's some more escape lab animals that we can laugh about. But here's the parting wisdom I would give is, employers, we see you and we feel you. I think you're caught in very difficult situations that I can't imagine anybody 20, 30 years ago entering the field of human resources.
That's right.
Probably we're not thinking my job is going to be involving making life or death decisions sometimes.
That's right.
On behalf of my people and recognizing that. So we feel you.
And we see you. Well
and
put.
We see you. So.
Well put. I like it. On
well,
that note.
Yeah. That's our show. And from Mako Rx and Proactive MD, I'm Jeremy Vanderknight.
And I'm Vinay Patel.
We'll see you next time.
Proactive MD.